Okay, so wonderful that everyone is here. We are continuing our look at Mark chapter 9. We have finished the Transfiguration and the interesting interchange between Jesus and his disciples concerning the coming of Elijah in Mark chapter 9. And we started talking about the healing of the epileptic in Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 29. So here is, oh, hold on, I need to switch that over. There we go. There is the word cloud for Mark chapter 9. And let's see, we are now talking about this 16th miracle, rec as recorded, specific miracle, I should say, as recorded in the Gospel of Mark. It's also recorded in Matthew and Luke, so we'll learn a few things from that as well. We've talked about the dispute already that was going on here. Recall this dispute. Was going on, was happening between the disciples, likely the remaining disciples who were probably in Caesarea Philippi, those disciples, the nine that were left there, those disciples, along with the scribes who were there in that particular area. And if it's not in Caesarea Philippi, then it's an area near Mount Tabor, depending on wherever the transfiguration took place. So we are, let's go ahead and look at this. Mark chapter 9. We'll read, in fact, let's read this whole thing. Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 29, so we can get this feel again for what is going on here and have some idea of this context. All right, so Mark 9, verse 14. And when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. Immediately, when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed and running to him, greeted him. And he asked the scribes, what are you discussing with them? And then one of the crowd answered and said, Teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit. And wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples and that they should cast it out, but they could not. He answered him and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me. Then they brought him to him. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed foaming at the mouth. And he asked his father, How long has this been happening to him? And he said, From childhood. And he said, well, so verse 22, and often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, Deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more. Then the spirit cried out, convulsed him greatly, and came out of him. And he became as one dead, so that many said he is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. And when he had come into the house, his disciples asked him privately, Why could we not cast it out? So he said to them, This kind can come out by nothing but prayer and fasting. All right, so that is the from the New King James Version, and that'll be important later as we discuss this particular event. All right, so we already discussed last week what the nature of this dispute was, and likely what happened here. Again, a dispute between the scribes here and the remaining nine. They could not cast out this particular demon that was inhabiting, that was possessing this poor boy, this poor individual. And so likely the scribes were pointing it out, were making fun of them, saying, "Ha!" They believe they finally found something to pin Jesus, to pin on Jesus. "Ha, you think you can do this, but you can't even do that." Well, now this is clearly not what the takeaway should be, because of course Jesus later comes and takes care of it. But let's consider the problem as we are going on to this next section. The problem here that we have, we notice that the father, a particular father, he comes forward and begs Jesus for help. He likely saw the disciples in likely Caesarea Philippi in the area, and said, "Well, his disciples are here. He might have recognized them, or maybe someone pointed them out and said, 'Oh, these are his disciples. Can you do something for my boy?'" And they were not able. But then Jesus comes, and he comes to Jesus and begs him for help. The first thing that he mentions there in verse 17, the first problem we note is that he has a mute spirit, a mute spirit. Then he describes what it does to his son when it seizes him there in verse 18. In fact, in fact, when the boy is brought to Jesus in verse 20, he demonstrates right there just what the father said. So it's explained there in verse 20. Well, it's explained in verse 18, and then we actually see it then in verse 20. What's going on there? The boy, we note, says nothing this whole time. So it would appear that this demon is also causing him to be deaf and dumb, as Jesus addressed the demon later in verse 25. We note that the father himself says this is a mute spirit in verse that we see this in verse 17. In verse 25, we note that Jesus himself talks to the spirit, says this deaf and dumb spirit, meaning mute, one that cannot speak. One of the things that's interesting that kind of, to me, says that maybe this is indeed a person who is deaf and dumb, or deaf and mute, or something of that nature, something along those lines, is that there's one thing that's absent here that was present with all of the other demon possessions that we've seen in the book of Mark. And that thing was a confession of who Jesus was. We see in that this is very prominent. This particular confession is prominent in Mark chapter 1, the first time we see this. We see it in Mark chapter 5. We see it anytime a demon has been cast out, that Jesus shushes the demon and says, "Hey, no, don't speak. Don't tell anyone about this." And so we note that this doesn't happen with this particular spirit, and perhaps it's because there is a mute aspect to this particular demon. Now, and again, I don't know all the demonology behind it, things of that nature, and people do come up with some fanciful theories, but suffice it to say, this particular spirit made this individual likely deaf and perhaps mute as well. All right. Another aspect that we see here is that the symptoms described sound like an epileptic seizure. If you're at all familiar with those kinds of that kind of malady, I not so much. I might have seen it a few times with some people, but not very familiar with it. But we do see that this particular person, as described by certain people who know a little bit more about this than I do, that this is consistent, that the behavior here is consistent with epilepsy. So that's one reason why this person is called the epileptic. Now, he is not called the epileptic here in Mark. He's not called the epileptic in Luke either, but he is, at least in certain versions. We see up here in Matthew chapter 17 and verse 15. We see there that in that particular passage that if you're looking at the New King James says that he is an epileptic. Well, that particular word translated as epilepsy, because epilepsy is a condition that didn't have a name until well after the King James was, well, I don't know if it was after the King James was written, but it was after, certainly after the first century when this was happening. So they couldn't quite identify this whole thing that we call epilepsy. So this particular word here in Greek is seleniadzetai. Now, that's an interesting word, not just because it's fun to say. but it literally is from the Greek word. It is the verb form of the word moon. So we might think in English what the verb form of moon is, to moon. Not what we're talking about. Not what we're talking about. but if you're looking at Matthew chapter 17 and verse 15, and you see at the bottom, it has in the in a footnote for that particular word for epilepsy or epileptic in verse 15, it says literally moonstruck. Moonstruck. Well, so in other words, the moon is doing something to a particular person. Generally speaking, it was supposed that such symptoms that this particular person was having worsened as the moon became more full. As I noted, the New King James translates this word as epileptic. If you have a King James and some other translations, it translates it as lunatic. There's luna, that's Latin for moon as well. So you have that aspect as well. Lunatic, the moon. The most common in the modern translations that I've seen is he has seizures. And that's, they don't go to try to diagnose it like the New King James does, but simply says that he has seizures. And of course, that's evident from the description of the symptoms that are described here. Apparently, though, that this was a condition that that this particular boy has had since childhood. So Sam and I discussed this after class last week. It's unclear how old the boy is at this point. There is no indication of age. But in any event, he has suffered for several years with this particular condition. On top of the seizures, the father relates that the demon would intentionally harm the boy. Now, that is, again, an aspect that we do see with a lot of demons, particularly the demon called Legion, or the demons called Legion collectively in Mark chapter 5, that they tried or they did harm the particular man that they were possessing. Well, then we see in verse 19 and a little bit later, verse 19, Jesus says, "O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I be with you? Shall I bear with you? And bring him to me." And he asks the boy to be brought to him. And then in verses 22 through 24, the father says, "But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." So you have this idea now of faithlessness that is being discussed. And boy, that's important to us because we need to understand the efficacy, if you will, of faith. How effective faith is in our lives. Well, when Jesus is told that the disciples they couldn't cast out this particular demon, Jesus calls this generation a faithless generation. We see that in verse 19. It's clear that he does not mean that one is completely devoid of faith. It appears, however, that he is lamenting the fact that his disciples, that the people who have been with him this whole time. Now, these particular nine obviously didn't see the transfiguration or the healing or the raising of the girl, Jairus' daughter, but they saw so much. And in fact, they were there at the confession of Peter. And they were there when Jesus predicted the first time. The second time hasn't happened yet, but that first time when he predicted his death and resurrection. They were there for all of this, and yet they still seem to lack the faith that is needed. So he's not talking about someone who's completely devoid of faith. But it does appear that he's lamenting the fact that his disciples, despite all that they have seen and done, were lacking in faith to some extent. He wasn't going to be with them for very much longer. We note that he is beginning his march to Jerusalem, to the cross, and he won't be able to be there with them after that. He can't hold their hand through this anymore, or at least not for much longer. One day they would have to truly see, as the blind man eventually saw, as we see in Mark chapter 8, verse 25, the connection between the blind man healed in Mark 8 and the events here. Apparently, it wasn't only the disciples who lacked faith, but the Father did to some extent as well. It's no surprise. I mean, consider, put yourself in the shoes of this particular father. Put yourself in the shoes of this man who has just, who has had this child. Who knows how long he's been going through this? Perhaps years. I mean, you would think he would have gone to the local exorcists, because there were Jewish exorcists who had gone around and done these things. Perhaps he's gone to them. He's gone to the priests, probably. I mean, he's gone to different people, very likely, in order to have this, and they could do nothing. And then he goes to Jesus' disciples, and now they can't do anything. So it's no surprise that his faith is faltering at this point. We note that the Father begs for compassion. And now, wouldn't you, if your child was going through this, wouldn't you want someone to have pity on you, to help you if they could? He begs for compassion. Little does he know who he is talking to. He's talking to the Son of God, to Jesus himself, to God himself. This father says in verse 22, "If you can do anything, if you can," suggesting that maybe there's a possibility that he cannot. Other manuscripts, we see Jesus' words here. Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." Now, obviously, he believes. Excuse me for a second. Obviously, he believes to some extent. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone to Jesus, right? He's got to believe to some extent. But clearly, that's not what is going on here. It's not any level of faith, any measure of faith. So, other manuscripts, as I mentioned, read Jesus' words a little bit differently. And I think I like that reading better because of what it brings out. And it makes a bit more sense than what we see here in the New King James. And it says, Jesus says, if you can, you don't know who you're talking to. You're talking to the Son of God. I can do anything. And so that is the point that Jesus is, I think, trying to make here. If you can, all things are possible to him who believes. And again, I think this wording makes a little bit more sense than what we see here in the New King James. It turns Jesus' comments into one who is slightly less incredulous or slightly more incredulous. Are you suggesting that I, the Son of God, cannot do something? Then he brings the discussion back around to faith and the requirement of faith in such things. I'm sorry, did you, I heard something. Sam, did you have something?
So verse reads, you jump from reading the verse to your interpolation. So the verse reads, Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. And you make a good point that, you know, and we forget a lot of times because we're used to saying punctuation. The Greek doesn't have punctuation. So there's no commas in there. There, you know, the periods and commas that we see that help us break up thoughts aren't there. It does make sense for him to say, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes, right? It makes sense either way. But I think you're right that, you know, the thing we have to keep reminding ourselves is those are things that interpret the people who do the translations have to make a judgment call on. And sometimes they make different judgment calls. That's why we study multiple translations.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think that makes a little bit more sense to me. Now you could disagree with me on that, and that's fine.
I think you're right.
Well, I don't mean you specifically. I mean the people who are, other people who might be, watching as well, who might be, tuning in. Because I do think that makes more sense. And for anyone else, I know Sam says he agrees, but for anyone else, if you disagree with that, I mean, that's fine. There's a little bit of wiggle room there. In any event, there now brings a question. And the first of the discussion questions that we have here today, are all things really possible to one who believes? Is Jesus literally saying that everything we can think of is possible if we simply have enough faith or believe hard enough? Any thoughts there?
Well, there's a couple points. I mean, first of all, Jesus isn't telling the person all you have to believe and it's going to happen automatically just because you believe it, right? Jesus is involved. He's the one that actually does it. Obviously, there's all the scriptures that say, you know, if the Lord wills, right, that it's, but there is the thing that says, you know, if you have faith the size of a grain of mustard seed, you can tell this mountain, be thrown into the sea and it'll obey you. Right. So there's more here than just, you know, a chiding of this person. There's a statement here about the power of faith, but in accordance with God's will.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I have on here a for instance question. For instance, if we believe hard enough, can we jump off the roof of a building and expect to fly? Answer, no. Please don't jump off the roofs of buildings. I don't care. Unless you're, what is it? There are people who do that, but they have parachutes at least. Free fall. I can't remember what they're called. There is a sport that's kind of like skydiving, but it's off of a building. Anyway, I can't remember what it's called off the top of my head, but unless you're involved in that and you can do so safely and legally, because it's not legal in a lot of places, then, you know, fine. Take all the precautions that you can. but that's not what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about, like you can fly off of a building and do whatever. No. Please don't do that. Please don't do that. Base jumping, I think is what it's called. Base jumping. Anyway. What Jesus is using here. Now, this is a favorite passage by a lot of people who seem to think that if you just believe hard enough, God is going to grant you a new car, a new house, lots of money, a spouse. No. That's not what we're talking about here. We see that Jesus is using a figure of speech. He's emphasizing the power of God and of faith involved in that. Jesus is informing these people that while his disciples were unable to do this particular thing, that he can. He, after all, is the Son of God. He has the power to do the impossible. One preacher said, Do not ever underestimate the power of faith. Don't forget, when you live your life, faith is very important. It is a great power that operates in your life. That's the point I think that Jesus is trying to get across here. That things are possible if we believe, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen. In any event, faith is a great power, is a great motivator. The father then realized that he was lacking in faith. His son had been in this situation again for so long that this was his last ditch effort to save the boy, similar to the woman with the flow of blood for so many years. That was her last ditch effort to be healed from that malady. This is the father's last ditch effort. The lame man in Mark chapter 2, that was his last ditch effort, clawing through the tiles on the roof to have him lowered down. Their last ditch effort. Couple this with the disciples' inability, and of course his faith would naturally falter. But he knew who to ask to help him with his faith. Help, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. He knew who to ask. He knew he had to ask Jesus. Now let's consider the casting out of this particular demon in verses 29 through 25. All right, and we have our casting out right here. Let's pull that down if I can. Nope. All right. Casting out. Let's see. Okay. So, these goings on, these things that are happening right at this point, appear to attract a greater audience, as we see in verse 25. When Jesus saw that the people came running together, attracting a greater audience that we see happening here, before too many people came, he wanted to cast this demon out. He quickly decided to cast him out. He commands the demon to leave and not re-inhabit this boy any longer. Leave and enter him no more. Come out of him. Enter him no more. As before with the other demon possessions, the demon left the boy violently, perhaps more violently, since he was so still that people thought that he was dead. Then he touched the boy, it says in verse 27, but Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. So there's a couple things and a couple possibilities I see could have happened. Perhaps that the boy actually did die, and Jesus touched him and raised him. Of course, there's no evidence of that in the text, so I tend to lean against that particular interpretation. But we do know that he touches the boy, and perhaps he was convulsing and had been hurt very badly, and so Jesus heals him. He takes his hand, just as he touched the leper in Mark 1. He touched the girl who died in Mark 5, and we see that this boy arose. How relieved that father must have felt by then, at that point. How relieved he must have felt. Then we see that the disciples leave, and they ask privately a question. They privately ask Jesus why they couldn't heal the boy. You know, and this, what Jesus responds here, tells them, no doubt excites many demonologists everywhere. First, he hints that there are different kinds of demons. He says, this kind. In verse 29, this kind indicates that there are different kinds. Well, obviously this kind is a deaf and dumb spirit. Again, I don't know what exactly that means, all the different kinds. We do know Mark chapter 5, that was many talked about there, legion, For we are many. So a lot were many were talked about at that point. Again, I don't know all the different kinds. Even if the Bible discusses all of them, in any event, we can probably guess that there are different kinds, but it doesn't matter too much for us. Then he states that some can only be cast out if the healer prays and fasts beforehand. Now, if you'll note at the bottom, or if you have a footnote with the New King James Version, it says that other manuscripts omits the word fasting, that this or and fasting. So this can be cast out, or this kind can only come out by nothing but prayer, is how some of those manuscripts end, just talking about prayer. Matthew is the only other one who records it, who records this section here. But in those same manuscripts, this whole verse is missing. Talking about prayer and fasting in Matthew 17:21 is not there in a lot of different versions or different manuscripts. So in Matthew, Jesus answers that it was due. He has an additional response in verse 20, that it was due to the disciples' lack of faith, which fits with what Jesus said earlier, "O faithless generation." So, I didn't put this in the discussion questions. Here's another question. Did Jesus have time to pray and fast before casting out this demon? Did he have time to pray and fast before casting out this demon? Well, I think he may have prayed, although we don't know it specifically. We do know that in Luke, we see at the Transfiguration that Jesus went up to the mountain to pray. So there was some prayer involved in the Transfiguration just prior to this event. At the same time, we can pray anytime. And so Jesus could have prayed for a moment within himself in order to cast out this particular demon. But doesn't fasting take a good deal more time? See, Luke records that Jesus was praying, as I mentioned, in Luke 9:28. He was praying on the Mount of Transfiguration. But it doesn't mention fasting. There's no mention of fasting at all in this particular account, or in these accounts. In fact, let's see if I can find it. I don't think he mentioned fasting here. Let me back up. I don't think fasting was in the original. I don't think Jesus said that fasting was part of this. Now, hear me out here. There's a couple of reasons. One, it's not in Matthew. It's not, well, it is in some manuscripts in Matthew. It's in some manuscripts in Mark. But again, I don't think he originally said that. And again, here's a couple reasons why. One, there's no mention of fasting. I don't think he had time to fast before this particular event. But at the same time, he did say much earlier in Mark chapter 2, verses 19 and 20. He says, and I have that up here, Mark 2, verses 19 and 20, that his disciples wouldn't fast until after he left them. So, no indication of fasting in this event, no time to have fasted, and then an indication against fasting during the ministry of Jesus for the disciples of Jesus in Mark chapter 2. So, I think with all of this, evidence suggests that fasting was not in the original. But I'll leave that to your understanding and to see if you might concur. I don't know. But here's my last question. And it actually relates to what Matthew says. So let's look at what Matthew says in Matthew 17. And verse 19. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" So Jesus said to them, "Because of your unbelief. For assuredly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. However, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." So there's that verse, verse 21, that was not in certain manuscripts, and again, I don't think was in the original, if for Matthew. But we do see a version of that here in Mark. In any event, what relationship? Because we see this attitude of unbelief, this response in Matthew about because of your unbelief, and this response in Mark about you need to pray. So then what is the relationship? What relationship does prayer have with belief? What does prayer have with faith? And that's the question I'd like to end with perhaps today. What relationship does it have? And perhaps fasting. I mean, we could, there is a possibility that it was there. But so what relationship does it have? Any thoughts, Sam?
Well, for sure, if you had no faith, prayer is a meaningless exercise. Right, so you can look at extremes, and sometimes that'll help make things clear. So if you didn't believe in God at all, why are you talking to God? Right, it makes no difference. I think the level of one's faith does have an impact. I mean, there's that scripture that says the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Right, you know, the level of one's faith is a yardstick that affects the effectiveness of your prayer, but that doesn't mean it has to be a great, mature, you know, decades old faith. I mean, a new Christian can have great faith in their prayers to God. But it, you know, as far as the fasting element, I mean, whether or not it's in the manuscript, and there are, you know, some cases like the scripture where it's kind of there or not. One thing for sure, there's a dedication required for fasting. And I think the seriousness and fervency of the prayer is probably linked in with this thought about the level of faith, right? It's one thing to say, yeah, I believe in God, so I'm going to, hey, God, can you take care of this, please? It's another thing to be anguished in prayer for hours over a question or request you have to God. Look at Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, right? You have Jesus, if anybody, could have just said a little millisecond prayer under his breath because he knew God and he was righteous and he knew God heard him. But yet he anguished for hours over what he was about to do. And I think there's a lesson in there about the intensity of our faith and our prayers.
Yeah, and I have, and I do have a couple points on that. I think I can mention it in a few minutes. What relationship does prayer have with our faith? I think prayer helps to increase our faith. I think prayer helps to increase our faith. So the more we pray, the more we show our reliance on Him, and then the more our faith then builds and increases. When we put all of our cares on Him, we then know that He can handle it, and that He will handle it in His own way on His own time. Both of these things, both fasting and prayer, can strengthen our reliance on Him, and on His strength, on His power, and on His majesty. And as children of God, we've got to depend on Him. We've got to, and in fact, we do note in all the lessons that we've had on Leviticus, that the Levitical laws were often designed to foster dependence upon God for all the things that they needed. And that's certainly true for us today. We need to be dependent upon Him. And that's one of the relationships that we see between prayer and faith. The more you pray, now the funny thing is, you know, the question is, help my unbelief. Well, if you pray, your belief, unbelief will be helped. You will believe more. Now, as Sam said, it's right. You know, he's right. Why pray at all if you have no faith? There's no point in that. You know, there are some people who I've talked to who said that they pray all the time, but they're atheists, things of that nature. Or agnostic. Now, how on earth does that make sense? Who are you praying to then? Are you just doing the thoughts? I mean, they're, you know the things that we say sometimes, thoughts and prayers with you. Well, thoughts are fine, but they do nothing unless you act on them. Prayers, on the other hand, and some people conflate the two, thoughts and prayers, but that's not the case at all. Prayer is so much more powerful. It can help to increase our faith. Not only that, we have the ear of the Almighty whenever we talk to Him. And that is a powerful and wonderful and beautiful thing that we should not take for granted. And again, it can build our faith, and all things are possible to him who believes. So pray more. Pray more, and your faith will be built up. I guarantee it. Actually, you don't need to believe me. Believe the Bible, and it says it, so I believe it. All right. So, any other last minute thoughts or comments before we conclude this and go on to our song service?
Nope.
Y'all didn't hear that. Well, you might have heard that, but Sam just said nope. Again, thank you all for joining us. We will start a new live stream in a moment for our song service. And so please stick around and join us for that. God bless you.